So good evening, everyone. My name is Linda, and I am the assistant for Discovering Buddhism. So if you have any questions, concerns, just let me know. Either catch me before or after class. Also, if you picked up either this week or last week the handout that's out there called About This Module or About Discovering Buddhism, I forget what it's titled. If you flip it over, I think towards the top part of the second page, there's an email address. So you can also email me. I'm happy to answer questions that way. Just a quick reminder to silence cell phones if you haven't already done so. And it looks like we're getting ready to get started. Thanks. Oh, yeah. Thank you, Christy. So thanks to our family program, we do offer child care during Discovering Buddhism. So if you have any questions about that, Christy's right here in front. She can answer questions. I can probably answer questions as well. So just in the back room next to where we take our shoes off is a class where the kids are going to hang out. And we've got some teen volunteers, maybe teen babysitters. So feel free to bring your little ones if you need to. All right, thanks.
Hello? 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 Alright. We got more people sitting on the floor this time. How many people were here? How many people were here last time? How many are here for the first time? Okay. So we had some rules at the last visit, but we'll go over those later on. Anyway, so let's start out. Who's going to be my omse? You know what omse means? The chant master. I need a chant master. Where's Rob, the ones that Robbie used? I don't want to skip around too much. 34? Okay. So, like I said, most people here are not going to be, aren't Buddhist, be shocked. I don't know, maybe you're a Buddhist and you don't know it. That's what happened to me when I was in Nepal. I went to my first meditation class I was traveling and I was in Kathmandu and I went up to Kopan Monastery. Any people ever been to Kopan? I'm sure there's some people here that have been to Kathmandu. To be sure. Anyway, so it's right behind Buddha Stupa, about a mile up the hill. And I went there and I had my camera and I was going to take all kinds of pictures and I decided to stick around and do this 1 month meditation course. And part of it was you had to commit. You had to commit to the full course. And we had teachers and there was a lot of this iconography. all these statues and things like this, and I was going, are you kidding me? I'm Presbyterian, you know, this is not my thing. I was sort of a lapsed Presbyterian at that point, but I'd never seen anything like it. So it's kind of interesting. But anyway, when I got there and I started listening to the teachings, it was like I was going, wow, those things make sense to me. Like, it's like I'd heard it before in my own head. I was going, wow, this resonates with what I already intuit, but I haven't been able to put it into words. And here these Tibetan lamas were saying it, and saying it in a way I could understand it. And actually, not only, you see these bumper stickers that say, just say no? I feel like ripping those off the back of cars, because it's hard to just say no, isn't it? It's hard. Our minds are out of control. So we need to train the mind to be able to say no. There's so many wonderful concepts in the world in terms of, oh yeah, everybody thinks compassion's great, right? Most people think compassion's a good thing. Kindness is a good thing. Being respectful is a good thing. Love is a good thing. Just be loving. That's just like that bumper sticker. Just say no. Well, it's hard to do. It takes practice and training. So the when I got to the monastery, this first experience with meditation, I'd done a little bit of meditation here in the States before, but it was I was never any good at it. And tried transcendental meditation. Anybody do that one? It's expensive, too. I didn't like to have to pay that kind of money. This is free. So anyway, and I paid for a mantra. I can't even remember it. But anyway, the point is that in the Dharma or the Buddhist teachings, the meditations actually help me, and I think help other people, not only things that we aspire to have in our lives in terms of inner peace, tranquility, loving kindness, compassion. There are actually methods to do that. There's actually meditations, you know, guided meditations and practices. Mindfulness is a big part of that. That's a huge part of it. So, let's start out by doing these prayers. And I think, Robbie, I did explain just a little bit last time. So we'll do refuge in bodhicitta. And remember I said the first two lines would distinguish, and like I said, we're not trying to convert people here, but the first two lines have to do with whether you're, you know, saying, well, I'm a Buddhist or not a Buddhist. Because you going for refuge means you're going to seek protection. Like in a hailstorm, if there's some covered area in a hailstorm, you take refuge in that under that covered area, right? Same way here. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened to the Buddha, Dharma, and Supreme Assembly. So that distinguishes people who are not Buddhist from people who are Buddhist. Again, this is just what we're doing. You don't have to, you can just creatively align with this for a few weeks. And then by the practice of giving and other perfections. So there's six perfections. Is the first one is generosity. And what are some of, anybody remember what the other ones are? Pardon? Well, patience is one. Ethics usually mentioned second. Patience is one. Enthusiasm is one, concentration, and wisdom. Those are the six. And I'll just stop before I go any further and say this, because I didn't get to say it in the first class. So ethics is the foundation of your meditation practice. So if you have any, you will never be successful. And I'm not just saying this to sound like it's like I know I have all the answers, but I just have heard it and experienced it. You cannot be successful with meditation if you spend most of your time like wincing because you remember something that you did yesterday or the day before, or even in this life. Things are going to come up, but if you're constantly creating a lot of ick for yourself and other people, that's what your meditation is going to be about, all that ick. So it's important. There are five lay precepts that are generally, you know, they don't completely observe them, but they try to. Is avoid killing. So killing. So if you do that, don't do it. Stop killing things and people and stuff. Stealing, lying, adultery, which is there's all kinds of definitions of adultery, but the easiest one is having sex with someone else's partner. That would cause a lot of bad feelings. Could get you killed. You don't want to do that. And then the last one's intoxicants. Now, you know, there's a lot of intoxicants out there. But the whole point of that one is we're trying to wake up, and if we're using intoxicants and it's confusing our mind, it's impossible to wake up. I could tell you this cute story about that, but I won't. Well, maybe I will now that I've started. So there was this monk, and he was, everybody, I just see some, a lot of people have heard it. There was this monk, and he was, he was trying to develop concentration. He was in retreat in a cave, and he was, he was eating just, you know, vegetarian meals, and his benefactor had this really gorgeous daughter that would bring him his food, and she kind of was smitten by this monk who had a vow of celibacy. So the story goes that, well, she came to see him one time, and she said, I might get this wrong, but I'll correct myself as I go. She said, I'm going to kill myself if you don't have sex with me. But she also brought a goat along with her. And she said, now, but I will give you some options here other than me killing myself. She said, you have three choices. And she also had a bag, had some alcohol, like a big thing of alcohol. She said, you have to do one of these three things or I'm going to kill myself. You have to either have sex with me, kill the goat, which she knew he had a vow of to not kill, or drink the alcohol. So he went, oh, my God, I mean, I don't want her to kill herself. So, you know, but I have a vow, you know, not to kill anything. So I'm not going to kill the goat. And I have a vow of celibacy, so I'm not going to have sex with her. Okay, I guess I'll drink the alcohol. Guess what happened? He did everything. He got drunk, killed the goat, and had sex with the girl. So the point is that alcohol or intoxicants can make us do stupid things. Again, so we've got to have a foundation of ethical behavior, and ethical behavior means not harming others. We can think of it really in real simple terms. And Buddhism ethics is about non-harming. Okay? So the practice of giving and the other perfections. So we talked about giving, ethics, patience or tolerance, concentration, and wisdom. Did I miss one? Enthusiastic perseverance, yeah. So those are the six. Okay, so by my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha for the benefit of all beings. So again, the motivation in Mahayana Buddhism, which is the tradition that we practice in, is that we, our goal, our aim, our motivation is to be of benefit to all living beings, and certainly not harm them. And the best way to do that is to get our act together. You know, there's so many well-intended people, but they, you know, even with a lot of compassion, but without wisdom, compassion can go way bad, right? I think these people that were flying the planes into the World Trade Center thought they were doing the right thing. You know, that was the right thing to do, but it obviously was not the right thing to do from our perspective. So, have to have wisdom. So, again, by my practice of giving other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. All right, so we'll say that one, and then we'll do the four measurables, which are measurable. So the may all beings have happiness, and the causes of happiness is a measurable love. And then be free of suffering, and the causes of suffering has to do with immeasurable compassion. May all beings be inseparable from the happiness that is free from suffering is joy. And may all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment and for friends and hatred for enemies. That's a measurable equanimity. So those are the things that we're aiming for. All right, let's read this. And we'll do that. We'll go all the way down to the mandala offering. I go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. Go for refuge until I'm enlightened, to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By my practice of giving and other perfections, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. May all sentient beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering. May all sentient beings be separate from the happiness that is free from suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Reverently, I prostrate with my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering, actual and imagined. I declare all my negative actions accumulated since beginning this time, and I rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma, living beings. I dedicate my own merits and those of all others to the great enlightenment. This ground, anointed with perfume, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon, I imagine this as a Buddha field and offer it. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. Idam Guru Radha Mandala Kamne Yatayami. Now, let's start out by doing a real simple meditation practice that we do a lot here at the center. It's called the nine-round breathing. And it's a nice way, you can do it in the day, whenever you get a little agitated or anxious. Pardon? Can people hear me? Yeah. So, the nine-round breathing, and it's probably easiest, you know, some people don't like, you know, close the nostril, other people do, you know, and they're different. Some people use the ring finger, and some people use it. It doesn't matter. But I like to close the nostrils. So what you do is you breathe in three times in the right side and three times out the left side. And then you breathe in three times in the left and three times out the right. And then you breathe three times in both nostrils and out. Okay? It's real simple. Now, there's a whole elaborate visualization of psychic channels and blah, blah, blah that we don't need to do. This is what we need to do. So we'll do this, you know, you can do this three or four times on your own. I'll guide you through the first time, and then you just do it on your own. You can, again, you want to sit up straight in your chair. If you're sitting in a chair, you want to sit with your back so you're not really leaning sort of back in the chair, but your spine is like coins stacked one on top of another. You want to sit up straight. And I don't know if you remember the different features of proper, I know some of you are new, but the proper meditation posture. Your shoulders are kind of down and slightly back. You can have your eyes slightly open or closed to let the light in. Sometimes can keep you more alert. Sometimes it's too much of a distraction for us beginners, so you figure whatever works for you. The chin is tucked in just a little bit. The tongue's at the roof of the mouth, because if you sit for any period of time, then saliva will just automatically drip down the back of your throat without you having to stop and go, swallow. That distracts you. Then you can sit cross-legged, or if you're sitting in a chair, you want both feet on the ground, and then your hands. Usually we use our fingers, or the right hand fingers on top of the left, and the thumbs. And you don't have to do this, by the way. You can even just sit there with your hands on your lap if you're more comfortable with that. But this is a traditional way of sitting. And then the arms are slightly away from the body to allow a little ventilation, particularly if you're going to, again, this posture is meant to be held for a long period of time. Once you get skilled at meditation, you'd like to be able to sit like this maybe for hours even without moving. So it obviously has to be a posture that's comfortable. So check in with your body and notice what your body is experiencing, the experience of sitting. And start out by taking just a couple of deep cleansing breaths, like three. Now take a finger and occlude the left nostril and breathe in the right nostril. And then occlude the right nostril and breathe out the left side. And that's one. Then repeat this, breathing in two. Out the left side, two. Breathing in three. And out the left side, three. Now breathe in the left side, one. Out the left side, one. Right side, sorry, one. In the left side, two. Out the right side, two. And the left side, three. Out the right side, three. Now in both nostrils, one. And out, one. And two. And out, two. And three. And out three. Now just repeat this, the nine rounds, a couple of more times on your own. Now, you can keep going, but if you lose count, which I'm going to bet at least one person did, you just start over. It's okay. No big deal. You're not, you know, this is just something, a new thing for most of us. You know, we're learning something new. We never discipline our mind this way. So go back to one and start all over again. Now, stop the counting and just continue to experience your breath. And again, for some of us, we talked about choosing the sensation of the breath at the tip of the nose. A lot of people do that, you know, when you breathe out, when you breathe in, it's kind of a little bit cool, and then you breathe out, it's warm. And you just try to keep your mind focused on that entire experience of breathing in and out. Really cranking your bringing a little bit of energy to this, bringing your awareness to the experience of breathing. Like I said, you know, when you look under a microscope and it's 10x, of course you can see everything, but when you go down to oil immersion, you really bring you can see so much more. You're more focused. It's that kind of focus you want to bring to your breath as you breathe in and out. To this, because when you breathe in, I want you to softly, mentally note breath, and as you breathe out, mental, soft mental note breath. As you breathe in, breath, breathe out, breath. Breathe in, breath. Breathe out, breath. Breathe in, breath. And breathe out, breath again. Just soft mental note. Now, what's going to happen, and not too many, you know, only a few breaths. For some of us, it may only be one. The mind's going to take off and go after something. Something could be anything. You know, a memory, something you're looking forward to, whatever it is. Whenever, when you notice that your mind is distracted, you say, not breath. That's all. Just say, not breath. And then come back to the breath. In, breath. Out, breath. In, breath. Out, breath. And your mind goes off to thinking about tomorrow. You go. And you, this could go on for 5 minutes before you realize you're gone. But when you note it, you say, you notice, not breath, and come back to the breathing. Let's do that for a few minutes. And when you're distracted, you just notice not breath and come back to breath. As you breathe in, breath as you breathe out. You can actually divide the breath into the beginning and like each inhalation into two parts and each exhalation into two parts. That might help you stay focused on the breath. Again, just mentally noting breath with each inhalation and exhalation. When you notice you're distracted, you know, you with this, with being mindful of being distracted, you notice, you say, not breath, come back to the breathing. Very simple. Gently bring the mind back again and again and again. It could happen 100 times in 10 minutes. Just depends on your skill. And when we focus on the breath, we notice that we're inhaling, and there's a moment right at the end of the inhalation, the breath sort of turns, and then begins the exhalation. And there's like a slight pause at the end of exhalation, as the breath turns and comes back to the inhalation. So it's real easy to lose the breath at the end of the inhalation and exhalation. So you need to stay focused through the entire process of inhalation and exhalation. Don't let the mind wander. Kind of tether the mind to the breath. That's our contract with ourselves, is to focus on the experience of breathing. Again, the point is not the soft noting of breath. The point is to stay completely focused on the experience of inhalation and exhalation without letting the mind wander. And that when it does, which it will often, you notice not breath, and come back to the breath. As we said in the last class, it's important to try to sit perfectly still. You know, any kind of movement of the body, and that's why it's important to get a comfortable posture. You can sit perfectly still as you do your meditation practice. This practice is in the what we call a concentration practice. Same thing with non-round breathing, where you're trying to focus on, keep the mind, let's focus on one object. There's another kind of meditation which we call analytical meditation. Vipassana is part of that genre of meditations. But we're going to do one of these guided meditations just for a minute now to set the motivation a little stronger. We're going to want to think about, we want to develop something called equanimity, because without that, there's no way to have compassion. So equanimity is just this mind, this levelness of mind where, for example, we imagine a friend, a stranger, an enemy, and we think of the friend and why we like them, because they say nice things to us, and they frequently won't tell us our faults. You know, that's why we call them our friend, right? And they've done nice things for us and so forth. So we label those people, those people friends. And then the strangers, which is the vast majority of living beings, human beings, we call them strangers. And we feel basic, the friend we're attached to, the stranger we are indifference toward. And then the so-called enemy, if you can bring to mind somebody you feel, I know some of you don't have enemies, but anybody that you feel resistance to, aversion to, that's good enough. And then notice that, you know, these people have done something that we don't like. They've said something. They've harmed either us or somebody that we care about. So they get labeled enemy, right? And then we can use various kinds of reasonings. We can think, okay, the friend is the friend of, you know, attachment and clinging, you know. And that person, you know, is the friend of my ego, my egocentricity. So is the friend, and the ego is my worst enemy. Is the friend of my worst enemy really my friend? So we're trying to lessen our clinging to the so-called friend. Over here, the person we feel aversion toward. We think, well, you know, this mind karma coming back to me, what goes around comes around. Furthermore, I need difficult people in my life to push my buttons so that I can develop inner strength and you know, having an easy life is not good from a spiritual standpoint, having just enough suffering that we get challenged. So these enemies push our buttons. They teach us what our faults are, and they give us an opportunity to practice patience. And without patience, there's no possibility for happiness. Without this kind of tolerance that the so-called enemy can teach us. So try to see this person in a little different light and lessen our sense of aversion toward them. And then we see the people in the middle that we feel indifferent toward, the vast majority of the strangers, right? We feel indifference toward them. And we don't feel hatred. We don't feel attachment. They're there. Like the faceless people in the elevator, right? And so here we have the friend, the stranger, and the enemy. And what we want to do is develop an equanimous state of mind. Now, all of these relationships are impermanent. There are plenty of examples where the so-called friend of today could be tomorrow's worst enemy. And the so-called enemy of today, just a few kind words, could become your new best friend. And then all of these people that are strangers, you know, all of your friends now, and enemies in fact, were formerly strangers. So these relationships are not fixed. So we want to develop sort of a level, equal regard is the best way to say it, for these three categories of beings. We want to have an equanimous state of mind to start this, to develop compassion, which is what we're shooting for. And then His Holiness the Dalai Lama, if anybody has ever heard him, he always, always, always starts his talks out with, everybody wants to be happy and nobody wants to suffer. And we're all just alike that way. It's like, why does he keep saying that? But it's true. We all want to be happy. We all equally want to be happy and equally don't want to suffer. We're all equal in that very important way. And then the next step in this evolution is beginning to recognize that our worst enemy is not out there. It lives in our mind, heart. It's a selfish, self-cherishing, egocentric, me, me, I am the most important one. That mind is the source of all of our suffering. From the Buddhist perspective, from the beginning of beginningless time until right this moment, all of our problems are caused by one demon, one demonic force, the self-cherishing, selfish I. You know, if you look at killing and stealing and adultery and lying and slander and harsh speech and pride and jealousy, and everything is driven by the ego. Everything. All the things, all the afflictive mental states and actions of body and speech and mind, all driven by egocentricity. Not our friend at all. And cherishing others is the attitude that creates happiness. And I'm not saying you have to believe it. I'm just saying, check it out. Lama Zopa, he has a bumper sticker that he gives people. It says, for happiness, cherish others. We cherish others. We don't kill from them. We don't steal. We don't commit adultery. We don't lie to them. We don't badmouth them. You know, badmouth or talk badly about them, speak harshly and offend them and waste their time with idle gossip and so on. So cherishing others is the cause of all happiness, and the self-cherishing mind is the cause of all suffering. And then the next step is to exchange selfishness, this self-cherishing attitude mentally. We're just playing with this. We want to, from now on, instead of living our lives a slave to self-cherishing selfishness, we want to exchange that attitude for the attitude that cherishes others. Okay? And now, we can almost imagine that. So now everything we do is motivated by this thought of cherishing others. Everything we do. We drive home tonight mindful of others, you know, not harming others as we drive home. When we, you know, we go to work in the morning to work for others. We, you know, take care of our health so we can be helpful for our family and beneficial to others and so on. So this is the kind of attitude that we want to train our mind to have. And then the next step is again, this has to do with developing this supreme attitude of wanting to help, to get enlightened in order to benefit all living beings. This attitude, the Sanskrit word is bodhicitta. But before you get there, you go to this point where you say, this is hard to chew or bite off, but I'm going to say it. This is the attitude of the spiritual warriors, the so-called bodhisattvas. They say, I am personally responsible for the happiness of all living beings. I take it on myself. Now, not everybody is ready for this one. It's okay. You don't have to be. But this is the attitude of the of the Bodhisattva, the future Buddha, is that they feel so connected to all living beings. They feel such a sense of connection and compassion for all beings. And they can't bear their suffering. And they want to stop their suffering. So they say, I take personal responsibility for the happiness of all beings. And then the next step is called the generation of bodhicitta, where we realize that even if we, that we can't do it, we don't have our act together, we haven't purified our mind, we haven't developed these positive qualities that we need to have, right? We haven't done the work, so we're not ready to do this. So even if our aspiration, our aspiration is to help others, and the method to do that is one's own enlightenment, one's own spiritual evolution. So I want to make a difference. Another way to say it, I want to be a better father. I want to be a better co-worker. I want to be a better citizen. I want to be to make a difference in my family, my community, and so on. And to do that, I have to get myself together. I have to develop my qualities and eliminate my faults. And so that's the attitude for spiritual practice. It's for others. I must help others. The method to do that is one's own spiritual evolution through the practice of all the things we've talked about, particularly meditation practice. That is the keys to the universe. So if you get some feeling, maybe this sounds crazy, and for some people this is really crazy. That's okay. For some people, they might have some feeling for it. If you develop some feeling this feeling behind the words, that truly is motivated by some love and some compassion for all beings and the wish to help them. If you have some feeling like that, then you don't analyze anymore. You just focus on that feeling, that experience, for just about a minute, just to let that become the object of single pointed meditation. Can relax, open your eyes, bring your attention back into the room. I just realize I have my own agenda, so there's not a lot of time for question and answer, because I want to cover some things, but we'll make time. And also, you can talk to your buddy. How many people actually talked to their buddy last week? Give yourself a hand, please. Good job. So That's really important. I mean, it makes a difference to have somebody to support you, and if you have questions and stuff like that, you can sometimes you can get the other person may have more experience or things like that. So I wanted to cover the Four Noble Truths real quickly, because this is all the schools of Buddhism. All the schools of Buddhism basically rely on these four teachings. I've tried to teach these to my kids. They can never remember them. I'll ask them again and again and again, what are the Four Noble Truths? I don't know what the Four Noble Truths are. So I say, look, I say, okay, we're sick. All right? That's dukkha. That's what dukkha means. It's a Sanskrit word, but you can't really define it in just a few words, but unsatisfactoriness, you know, usually it's translated suffering, but it's like, it's vast. It's not just broken legs and depression and anxiety and stress, but it's the fact that even the things that bring us pleasure and joy don't last. And we're all always left wanting more. Lama Zopa said, you know, the worst suffering in the whole world is this never being satisfied. It's like low level radiation. It's just always there poisoning our mind, poisoning our experience. We're never satisfied. Even when we're having the best experience of our lives, in the back of our minds, we know it won't last. And then when it's over, we're going, how can I get that again? And then we got to go out and find another fix, another hit. Remember I said addiction to deliciousness is what this great, saint in Thailand, Buddhadasa Bhikkhu. So I told my kids, I said, we're all sick, and there's a cause for the sickness. Influenza A. Or whatever it is. It could be bacteria. But there's a cause for the sickness. And then sickness can be cured. Right? And then here's the medicine. Take this medicine. Anybody had the flu this year? Probably a few. Amazing. Everybody got the flu shot. Good. Well, it wasn't that good this year anyway. It was only like 45% effective. I'm amazed. But anyway, so this is what the Buddha taught. When he got enlightened, about 20 under the Bodhi tree in Bodhgaya, India, he walked to Sarnath, which is near present-day Varanasi, and he saw some of his buddies, and he taught them. This was his first teaching, and the first thing he said was that this whole notion of another way of saying it is all worldlings are deranged. I've heard it said that way. We're worldlings, so we have to come to, if you don't think that you have problems or that your mind is out of control and that it's going to cause a lot of problems for you, it probably already is, and it's just going to get worse, right? Because we just have problems are queuing up. Things are going to happen tomorrow and next week and next year, and then eventually you're going to get sick. Sooner or later, you're going to get sick. Sooner or later, if you live long enough, you're going to get old. That's a lot of fun, right? The golden years. I hear it every day. Getting old is not for sissies. And then dying. How many people are ready to let go? And die with a peaceful, happy mind. To let go. just to be in the moment and just like 1 minute you're alive and 1 minute you're dead, and you do it with a joy and with a peaceful mind. Most of us are going to be freaking out. I've seen it. I've seen a lot of people die. I'm a physician. That's my job. And but you know, when I was training, I mean, you see it all the time. So dukkha, sickness. And then the cause of suffering is generally we tend to like to focus on attachment. You know, the real cause of suffering is ignorance, this mistaken sense of self or I. You know, ignorance projects a false sense of I, and then we believe it and we cling to it. I am so important. And of course, if somebody offends me, what happens? What happens? I get angry, right? And if somebody like really likes me and I like them, then I get attached, right? And if somebody tells me I'm great and all this stuff, my ego gets all puffed up and I get this what's called afflicted pride. And then if somebody like steals my girlfriend or whatever, your boy, whatever, you know, then jealousy. All these afflictive emotions come from this mistaken sense of self or I. But we generally point to these afflictions. The main poisons are greed and hatred and ignorance. These are the main ones. And the karma that they create, they set into motion that whether you believe karma or not, just think of it as what goes around comes around. I mean, and we all have that experience, you know? If you condition a certain kind of negative mind state, it'll revisit you again and again and again. So the causes of dukkha are karma and delusions. That's the cause of the sickness. And then the Buddha said, I got good news. And no other spiritual tradition, and certainly no psychological system that I'm aware of. You know, as one person said, I think Freud or somebody said, the best that psychology can do is take people from their neuroses to just everyday unhappiness. Doesn't sound that good, does it? But the Buddha's claim was, because dukkha has a cause, and it's mental, it's our mind, because we can change our mind and stop creating the causes to suffer, we can stop suffering. So the Buddha claimed, and this is, you do not have to believe a word I'm saying, by the way. These are all things that, from a Buddhist perspective, are verifiable by a student, but only a student who works their tail off to get to the point where they can experience it. But we can have a little taste of it. We can have a little taste of it in our meditation practice when we begin to see these things are true. They call them the noble truth, but these are things that great beings have seen directly. And they're very much a part of the practice of meditations that we're going to be doing later on. And then the path to the cessation. So that's the medicine. That's the Tamiflu, if you have the flu, or the whatever the medicine is. But the path, and it's broken down in a lot of different ways. In the Theravada tradition, which is the southern schools of Buddhism, it's ethics, concentration, and wisdom. Okay? Now that's also part of the Mahayana tradition, but we say it a little bit differently usually. We say this renunciation, bodhicitta, and emptiness. Alright? Renunciation is basically saying that you are sick and tired of being sick and tired. You recognize that we're in a unworkable situation with the kind of minds we have that's out of control. And we want to be free. So in an essence, it's like having compassion for yourself. Renunciation is having compassion for yourself. It's like, I don't want to suffer anymore. I want to be free. That's compassion for yourself. So then bodhicitta is compassion for others. That's a little meditation we just did. That's focusing on others. Like, I want to help others and others stop their suffering and be free of the causes of suffering. So that's bodhicitta. And then emptiness is seeing reality. Now, what does that mean, seeing reality? That's a hard one. How do you say, you know, so I'm not even going to go there right now. I touched on it last week. Every class will touch on it to some degree, and we'll talk about it more later on. But seeing things the way they are, minus our projections. What we do is right now, we vomit all, excuse me, that's too forceful here. We paint a picture of reality. Our ego has created, you know, billions of bits of karma, and it's ripening all the time, and it's literally projecting our world for us, creating our experience of reality. Okay? You know, so egocentricity has created the causes for us to have a world that doesn't work for us. Doesn't work. It's full of dukkha. So this wisdom that the Buddha's got was he stopped creating these imaginary worlds and believing them. His ego literally dissolved. He still had a sense of self, and he still could function and do everything else, but he wasn't driven by self-centered selfishness, which is our big problem. Okay? So that's the Tibetan version of it. Okay. One question. Any questions up until now? We'll take a few. Yes. Robbie told me to just shut up and ask questions. Let people talk. Now, the same people can always ask questions. But go ahead. You always have good questions.
So, is mindfulness and meditation, are they the same?
Are mindfulness and meditation the same? We need mindfulness to do meditation. You can't have meditation without mindfulness.
So are the same?
Not exactly the same, but they're definitely tied in together. For example, we use mindfulness to stay focused on the object, don't we? When the mind goes away, it's this type of interest. By the way, before I get into this, too much. If you read, those of you that were lucky enough to get the book Mindfulness in Plain English, Gunnar Ratna talks about how he says, you can't talk about mindfulness. It's something you have to experience. And this morning I went online, you cannot believe the number of definitions of mindfulness. Everybody believe, you know, in the Tibetan tradition, we talk about recollection, recollecting the object of meditation, for example. Joseph Goldstein, who's like one of my heroes, he started the Insight Meditation Society in Barre, Massachusetts, and his definition a few years ago, but it might have changed by now, was non-distractedness. But there's so many different meditations or words to describe mindfulness, but they're not mindfulness any more than may you be free of suffering and the causes of suffering is compassion. That's not compassion, is it? is that that's the Buddhist definition of compassion. But what's compassion? Come on, give me some words for it. Yeah, it's something you cannot put it into words. It is something. With mindfulness, we use a lot of words to talk around about it, but it is an experience that you will have in meditation, and that's the best way to let's not get caught up in trying to define it too much. There are characteristics of mindfulness and things that that mindfulness helps us do. I remember, Ajahn Buddhadasa Bhikkhu, he was talking about, for example, he was talking about just meditation in general. And he was saying, like, all of us, he said, what, say you're hanging out and you get upset about something, you get angry. And you notice that you're getting angry. Okay? And so you become mindful. Normally you just, it's like a tidal wave. It breaks and you start screaming and your heart rate goes up and your coronaries squeeze, people die in fits of anger. Right? But this time you notice yourself getting angry and you were mindful of yourself getting angry. And then you were also mindful of the remedy to anger, which if you can just let it go, do it. But if you can't, one of the remedies to anger is impermanence, recollecting impermanence, which is a kind of wisdom, right? So you bring to this moment of anger, you bring this awareness of impermanence. And you just, instead of react, you just watch it. And you can, there's some physical changes going on in your body when you're angry. Maybe your heart's beating, whatever. But you just watch it. Moment to moment to moment is changing. You just stay with it. What happens? Gradually, might take a while, but what happens? It disappears. And then, poof, you're back in the present moment again. And something else is going to come up. So, and he said, Buddhadasa Bhikkhu said, you don't know the Dharma until you've had that kind of experience, where you've been in a pickle, where your mind has been negative, or something that's disturbing your mind comes up, your experience of the moment, and you can. You're mindful of it. You become mindful that your mind is disturbed. And you bring some Dharma wisdom. If it's jealousy, you might bring the thought of rejoicing. If it's anger, you might bring the thought of love or impermanence. There are different antidotes to different mental states. You bring it to that moment, and you dissolve that negative mind state, and you're free. In that moment, it's like a moment of freedom. It's like a moment of nirvana. It won't last, but So he said, it isn't until then that you know the Dharma. Otherwise, you can read all these books, but that's not the Dharma. The Dharma is what you experience when you practice.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to play a little bit of this. This is called Mindfulness in Plain English. I can put it up. Here it is. And this reminds me so much. Now this is Gunaratna's book, but somebody's reading it, okay? And
okay.
All right. Let's see if it'll go.
Audible Studios presents Mindfulness in Plain English, written by Bhante Gunaratana.
Wait a minute. Oh, well. Can you push that? See if that'll go on. Put the push the Bluetooth thing on the top. See the. See if we can get it to connect. It was working earlier.
It's still flashing. The mic's back on.
Pardon?
It says the mic. Try it again.
Okay.
Audible Studios presents Mindfulness in Plain English, written by Bhante
Gunaratana,
performed by Eduardo Ballerini.
Well, you can hear this.
Chapter 1.
Yeah.
Meditation. Why bother? Meditation is not easy. It takes time, and it takes energy. It also takes grit, determination, and discipline. It requires a host of personal qualities that we normally regard as unpleasant and like to avoid whenever possible. We can sum up all of these qualities in the American word, gumption. Meditation takes gumption. It is certainly a great deal easier just to sit back and watch television. So why bother? Why waste all that time and energy when you could be out enjoying yourself? Why? Simple. Because you are human. Just because of the simple fact that you are human, you find yourself heir to an inherent unsatisfactoriness in life that simply will not go away. You can suppress it from your awareness for a time. You can distract yourself for hours on end. But it always comes back, and usually when you least expect it. All of a sudden, seemingly out of the blue, you sit up, take stock, and realize your actual situation in life. There you are. And you suddenly realize that you're spending your whole life just barely getting by. You keep up a good front. You manage to make ends meet somehow and look okay from the outside. But those periods of desperation, those times when you feel everything caving in on you, you keep those to yourself. You are a mess, and you know it. But you hide it beautifully. Meanwhile, way down under all of that, you just know that there has to be some other way to live, a better way to look at the world, a way to touch life more fully. You click into it by chance now and then. You get a good job. You fall in love. You win the game. For a while, things are different. Life takes on a richness and clarity that makes all the bad times and humdrum fade away. The whole texture of your experience changes, and you say to yourself, okay, now I've made it. Now I will be happy. But then that fades too, like smoke in the wind. You're left with just a memory. That and the vague awareness that something is wrong. You feel that there really is a whole other realm of depth and sensitivity available in life. Somehow, you're just not seeing it. You wind up feeling cut off. You feel insulated from the sweetness of experience by some sort of sensory cotton. You're not really touching life. You're not making it again. Then even that vague awareness fades away, and you're back to the same old reality. The world looks like the usual foul place. It is an emotional roller coaster, and you spend a lot of your time down at the bottom of the ramp, yearning for the heights. So what is wrong with you? Are you a freak? No, you're just human, and you suffer from the same malady that infects every human being. It is a monster inside all of us, and it has many arms. Chronic tension, lack of genuine compassion for others, including the people closest to you, blocked up feelings and emotional deadness, many, many arms. None of us is entirely free from it. We may deny it, we may try to suppress it. We build a whole culture around hiding from it, pretending it is not there, and distracting ourselves with goals, projects, and concerns about status. But it never goes away. It is a constant undercurrent in every thought and every perception, a little voice in the back of the mind that keeps saying, not good enough yet. Need to have more. Have to make it better. Have to be better. It is a monster. A monster that manifests everywhere in subtle forms.
Go to a party. Listen to the laughter, those brittle-tongued voices that express fun on the surface and fear underneath. Feel the tension, the pressure. Nobody really relaxes. They're faking it. Go to a ball game. Watch the fans in the stand. Watch the irrational fits of anger. Watch the uncontrolled frustration bubbling forth from people that masquerades under the guise of enthusiasm or team spirit. Booing, catcalls, and unbridled egotism in the name of team loyalty, drunkenness, fights in the stands. These are people trying desperately to release tension from within. These are not people who are at peace with themselves. Watch the news on TV. Listen to the lyrics of popular songs. You find the same theme repeated over and over in variations. Jealousy, suffering, discontent, and stress. Life seems to be a perpetual struggle, an enormous effort against staggering odds. And what is our solution to all this dissatisfaction? We get stuck in the if-only syndrome. If only I had more money, then I would be happy. If only I could find somebody who really loved me. If only I could lose 20 pounds. If only I had a color TV, a hot tub, and curly hair, and on forever. Where does all this junk come from? And more important, what can we do about it? It comes from the conditions of our own minds. It is a deep, subtle, and pervasive set of mental habits, a Gordian knot that we have tied bit by bit, and that we can only unravel in just that same way, one piece at a time. We can tune up our awareness, dredge up each separate piece, and bring it out into the light. We can make the unconscious conscious, slowly, one piece at a time. The essence of our experience is change. Change is incessant. Moment by moment, life flows by, and it is never the same. Perpetual fluctuation is the essence of the perceptual universe. A thought springs up in your head, and half a second later, it is gone. In comes another one, and then that is gone too. A sound strikes your ears, and then silence. Open your eyes and the world pours in. Blink, and it is gone. People come into your life and go. Friends leave, relatives die. Your fortunes go up, and they go down. Sometimes you win, and just as often you lose. It is incessant. Change, change, change. No two moments ever the same. There is not a thing wrong with this. It is the nature of the universe. But human culture has taught us some odd responses to this endless flowing. We categorize experiences. We try to stick each perception, each mental change in this endless flow into one of three mental pigeonholes. It is good, bad, or neutral. Then, according to which box we stick it in, we perceive with a set of fixed habitual mental responses. If a particular perception has been labeled good, then we try to freeze time right there. We grab on to that particular thought, fondle it, hold it, and we try to keep it from escaping. When that does not work, we go all out in an effort to repeat the experience that caused the thought. Let us call this mental habit grasping. Over on the other side of the mind lies the box labeled bad. When we perceive something bad, we try to push it away. We try to deny it, reject it, and get rid of it any way we can. We fight against our own experience. We run from pieces of ourselves. Let us call this mental habit rejecting. Between these two reactions lies the neutral box. Here we place the experiences that are neither good nor bad. They are tepid, neutral, uninteresting. We pack experience away in the neutral box so that we can ignore it, and thus return our attention to where the action is, namely, our endless round of desire and aversion. So this neutral category of experience gets robbed of its fair share of our attention. Let us call this mental habit ignoring. The direct result of all this lunacy is a perpetual treadmill race to nowhere, endlessly pounding after pleasure.
MP3 tape that I bought, and I was able to download it to my computer and put it on my cell phone. That's the only reason I have it here. And it's nice because you can listen to it in the car and stuff like that. So, you have a little bit of homework. Linda, you want to hand out that? Okay. If you have any questions, first of all, I'd like for you to set up, before you go, I'd like for you to set up a time to talk to your buddy before you leave. Set up a time to have a conversation this week just to check in, you know, see how that person's doing, support them. You can support one another in being here next week. Now, those of you who are Brent, who were not here the first time, we asked everyone that was here, and I know this, you missed the first class, so here you are, but we asked everyone that was here that was willing to commit to being here every time, and I asked people to really commit. Like, if you can't come every time, then please consider not coming, because you're not going to get the experience. And then you're going to walk away going, well, meditation doesn't work, or blah, blah, blah. And I don't want that to happen. So if you're not willing to commit, and those of you who came tonight for the first time, then you can watch it on streaming. There are lots of good books out there and all of that, but consider not coming back. It's okay if you do, but consider that you're not really going to do yourself any favor unless you're 100% in the game. Do the practices at home. I ask people to meditate every day, and we're basically focusing now on using the breathing techniques that we've discussed. Do that. And then come back next week, and I've given some reading assignments too. And Kathleen's book, How to Meditate, not too much to read. And then next week we'll work on some different techniques and stuff. I will say this real quick. This is just some of my personal experiences, and I wanted to give everybody a taste of different kinds of meditation, because back in the day, I had a chance, because I took time off to go and live in India and Asian places like that on about three different occasions, and so I got a chance to live in Thailand for 6 weeks, and I was in three monasteries, and I actually got to try three different Vipassana practices. I mean, even in the Thai tradition, which is Theravada Buddhism, there's a lot of differences in how they practice Vipassana. And then I went to Japan, and I went to the Rinzai temple, where they beat you with sticks, which was interesting. No, I'm just kidding. No, I'm serious. You'd be sitting there in the morning. It'd be like 4 o'clock in the morning, and the monks were chanting the sutra, and it would be like sub-zero, and you'd ask for a blanket, and they'd say no. And the monks were all over there, covered up. And then when you got tired, you'd raise your hand, and they'd come by and whack you with a stick. There's a lot of styles of meditation out there, right? And then I did that was Rinzai, and then I did a Soto retreat for a whole week with these two, there were two monks, and we did the whole week. There were people that would come and go, but three of us were the only ones that survived the whole week. My knees are still suffering from that retreat, because we would sit for 50 minutes, walk for 10 minutes, sit for 50, walk 10, sit 50, and face the wall. And you know what the instruction was? What? It was just sit. Yeah, just sit. And face the wall. You can learn a lot. It's a very profound practice. Sounds crazy. But when you sit there, you watch your mind, and when your body starts hurting, and you're not supposed to move even a little bit for 50 minutes. So happy when I got to get up and walk. So anyway, I've had a chance to taste different styles of meditation, I think we'll give a little taste of each of those before the class is over, because some people might be attracted to just sitting. And some people might be, no, I'm serious. The Rinzai tradition is actually quite powerful. They use a lot of koans and stuff like that. It's quite, quite effective for certain people with certain predispositions. Tibetan tradition just seemed to suit me. But I loved them all. I loved every one of the places I practiced. So we say the dedication prayer here. We'll run out the door. All right, on page 246. Okay, may all beings everywhere, plagued by suffering of body and mind, obtain an ocean of happiness and joy by virtue of my merits. May no living creature suffer, commit evil, or ever fall ill. May no one be afraid or belittled with a mind weighed down by depression. May the blind see forms and the deaf hear sounds. His bodies worn with toil be restored on finding repose. May the naked find clothing, hungry find food. May the thirsty find water and delicious drinks. May the poor find wealth, those weak with sorrow find joy. May the forlorn find hope, constant happiness and prosperity. May there be timely rains and bountiful harvest. May all medicines be effective and wholesome prayers bear fruit. May all who are sick and ill quickly be freed from their ailments. Whatever diseases there are in the world, may they never occur again. May the frightened cease to be afraid and those bound be freed. May the powerless find power and may people think of benefiting each other. For as long as space remains, for as long as sentient beings remain, till then may I too remain to dispel the miseries of the world. So thank you for your endurance. Yeah, there are this in the handouts.
Yes, so just outside the back door on the table is tonight's homework. You can pick up a copy there. But if I can get a quick show of hands of, we'll try to order some more of the Mindfulness in Plain English books. Can I get a quick show of hands of who would want to purchase one here at the Kanapa Center? Hold your hand up high and I'll get a count real quick.